Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, the on-again, off-again, do-not-call registry is off again.
And a chronicle of an American National Guard unit in Iraq, under pressure, under-equipped.
The most shocking thing was that their M16s were hand-me-downs from the Vietnam War that had been retooled, and that every nine-man squad has one radio, so they have to buy their own Motorola walkie-talkies.
Also, what does punk rock have to do with Zen Buddhism?
I thought there was some kind of relationship, because what we were trying to do in the whole punk rock thing was to try to be very truthful and very straight without a lot of the BS that goes on.
These stories and the 10 Democrats debate coming up here and now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. The Census Bureau reports that national poverty rates rose last year. It says nearly 34 million Americans were considered to be living in poverty. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Median household income dropped 1.1% last year to about $42,000 a year. Regionally, the picture was uneven. Income held steady for workers in the South, the area of the country that still has the lowest income rates. The Midwest fared the worst last year with the largest increase in poverty. Families who managed to stay employed during the recession fared best with no measurable declines in income. This helped hold the child poverty rate steady at 16%, down significantly from recession years in the 1980s and 90s. Within ethnic and race groups, the incomes of whites held steady, while average money income for blacks and Asians declined 2 to 3%. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
The body of Akila al-Hashimi was buried today in Najaf. She was a member of the U.S.-appointed Interim Governing Council in Iraq. She died yesterday, 5 days after being attacked by gunmen. From Baghdad, NPR's Emily Harris reports.
Friends, family, and other members of the Governing Council joined a memorial service and funeral procession for Hashimi in Baghdad. They said her death was a personal loss and a loss for Iraq. Hashimi was the only member of the council to have served in Saddam Hussein's regime. She worked closely with Tariq Aziz, the former deputy prime minister, and she ran the oil for food program in Iraq. She also held a Ph.D. in French literature. The top U.S. official here, Paul Bremer, says Hashimi was a pioneer for the cause of freedom and democracy. Hashimi's death happened on the same day a mortar hit a marketplace in Bakuba, killing Iraqi civilians, and a U.S. military convoy came under attack in Kirkuk. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
Iraq will be one of the topics today as President Bush welcomes Russian President Vladimir Putin to the Camp David retreat. The president is hoping to reach consensus with Putin on Iraq's future. Singer Robert Palmer has died of a heart attack in Paris. Palmer recorded a string of hits in the 1980s, including Addicted to Love and Simply Irresistible.
Simply Irresistible.
Robert Palmer was 54, and best-selling author George Plimpton has died in his sleep. Plimpton wrote about sports from a fan's point of view. His best-known books are Paper Lion, about playing football with the Detroit Lions, and The Bogeyman, about professional golf. George Plimpton was 76. Stocks are trading lower this hour. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are down 20 points to 93.23. The Nasdaq's down 12 to 18.04. The S&P is down 4. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, a federal judge in Denver has thrown up another roadblock to the national Do Not Call list. The judge ruled that the list violates free speech protections because it allows telemarketing calls from charities while blocking those from commercial enterprises. His ruling came after both the House and Senate passed legislation giving the Federal Communications Commission the power to create and administer the list. The economy grew faster than previously thought during the second 3 months of the year. That's according to the Commerce Department. Today it released final gross domestic product numbers for the second quarter. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The 3.3% annual growth rate for the economy topped most economists' estimates and was the strongest showing for the economy since the third quarter of last year, when it grew at a 4% annual rate. The report, which measures the total output of goods and services within U.S. borders, would seem to backstop the position of many economists who've said they expect more robust growth during the final half of this year. Along with stronger spending by consumers, a big boost in defense spending was another factor driving the economy. Defense spending soared by more than 45%, its biggest gain since the Korean War, primarily a result of U.S. involvement in Iraq. One weak area was corporate profits, which declined by 5% after taxes. However, non-residential investment, considered a key measure of businesses' willingness to spend, grew. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Shares of Motorola lost about 5% in early trading this morning. That after the Wall Street Journal reported that shipments of the company's first camera phones are being delayed. That means Motorola will miss out on holiday sales. The company is already months behind other companies in offering camera phones. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Officials in Washington are scrambling to react to the twists and turns in the Do Not Call Registry saga. Yesterday, a second judge declared the program illegal and a violation of free speech because it allows calls from charities and nonprofits, such as public radio stations, but not most commercial enterprises. The judge said the registry entangled the government in people's lives, deciding which calls the public would receive. A first judge blocked the registry earlier this week on narrower grounds, sending Congress scrambling to pass legislation to allow the registry to launch next week. But the new ruling trumps the congressional vote, and the Federal Trade Commission is expected to appeal that ruling, perhaps within the hour. Well, joining us on the line is Ryan Foley of the Wall Street Journal. Ryan, with a pending appeal, it would seem the FTC registry couldn't start on time.
Yes, there's almost unanimous agreement that the Do Not Call Registry will not be launched next week. Now, complicating matters is the fact that the Federal Communications Commission has similar rules that give it the authority to establish a Do Not Call Registry. And the big question is if the FCC is going to move forward with that. Mm. But those rules are also under court challenge by the telemarketing industry right now.
And complicating things even further, individual states have their own Do Not Call registries.
Yes, and yesterday's ruling, the second court ruling, appears to cripple almost every state registry because it challenges the fact that these registries allow exemptions for political and charitable organizations. Mm-hmm. And says that that's unconstitutional because the government is entangling itself in what forms of speech citizens can and can't hear from. Mm-hmm.
And complicating things even further, the telemarketing industry itself is split over this because the Do Not Call Registry also allows an exemption for companies that already have a business relationship with a customer. Those companies, are in favor of this because it sort of, you know, narrows the field of phone calls you might get, and they can still call those customers that have already had a business transaction with them.
Yeah, that's true for up to 18 months. But consumers should also know that they can ask those individual companies that they have business relationships with to put them on their do not call, their individual do not call list.
Right, you can do that. Well,
yes.
How hot a political potato is this?
It's a very, very hot political potato. It's rare to see Congress act within 24 hours of a court ruling and passed legislation nearly unanimously.
Which is good for them because, the cynic might say they're exempt from the Do Not Call Registry. They can still make calls. But it is a campaign year, and they recognize how angry Americans are.
Yeah, it was a clear reflection of how angry average Americans are about this issue.
What happens to the list, Ryan, as this the question about the list goes through the appeals process? It occurs to us that you now have the names of 50 million Americans that companies are already purchasing that list. What happens to the list?
Yeah, well, more than 5,000 companies have purchased that list or sections of it. And the Direct Marketing Association, one of the leading industry trade groups, is urging its members to follow the list regardless of what happens in the court.
In other words, to not call the people on the list.
Correct, yeah. Correct. And they argue that, as do some of the companies, that the list will help them be more effective because it will allow them to contact only those people who want to be called in the first place.
So there's a chance that the marketplace might actually take the place of legislation.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
One last question. While this goes through an appeals process, mm-hmm. is there any more legislation expected, a presidential veto, anything political expected?
Yesterday's ruling appeared to move the issue from Congress to the courts, and so we just have to wait and see what happens in the courts.
Mm. Well, Ryan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ryan Foley, staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from Washington, D.C.
The Pentagon may call up thousands more National Guard and Reserve troops to serve in Iraq. A senior general indicated this week that the mobilization is possible in the next few weeks, made more likely by the failure of the Bush administration, at least so far, to convince other nations to commit troops. More than 200,000 reservists and guard troops have been assigned to active duty in the past 2 years. 80,000 of them are in Iraq now, the majority of American troops there. To find out about the conditions they're serving under, we're joined now by journalist and author Christian Parenti, who recently spent time with a Florida National Guard company in Baghdad. His story, stretched thin, lied to, and mistreated, is a chronicle of anger and despair. It appears in the current issue of The Nation. Christian Parenti, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Alpha Company of the 3rd Battalion of the 124th Infantry crossed into Iraq on the first day of the war. They've seen a lot since then. But when you embedded with them, they spent a lot of time sitting around, too, didn't they?
They did. The heat is so intense there that those who go out on foot and patrol the neighborhood where they're based limit those patrols to 4 hours a day. Other tasks, if they're pulling guard duty, they might be on for longer. But there is a lot of hanging out in the base, and that's also because it's not safe for them to go out in the neighborhood.
Christian, there's an image in your article of that base, this warren of rooms they live in. Describe it.
Well, their base is called the Club. It's an old Republican Guard officer's club that was looted during the war. And they've fortified it with sandbags and plywood and razor wire. And behind the club itself, which is this modernist slab of broken mirrored glass and marble, there's this dormitory in which there's probably 200 or more guys packed into these little rooms. And they're one-bedroom apartments without a kitchen. There'll be 9 guys in there. And the windows, for reasons of safety and also for reasons of climate, are boarded up with plywood. So it's very dark in these rooms, lots of guys, their gear, their guns. They'll have these large metal Iraqi water-based air conditioners going to get the temperature down from 120 to maybe just 105 degrees. And people, the soldiers will lay low in there and listen to music and hang out and try and rehydrate. They're actually not given that much bottled water, only 2 liters a day, and then after that they have to drink from water buffaloes, which are these large chlorinated tanker trucks that sit in the sun all day and produce water that tastes like a swimming pool water. And then when they're not doing that, when they're not cooped up in their base, they're out on the street.
Armed. Where everyone is a potential killer.
Exactly. And they're greeted with a mix of hostility and hospitality by the Iraqis, but they never really know what's coming.
Tell me about the equipment.
Well, the most shocking thing was that their M16s were hand-me-downs from the Vietnam War that had been retooled. And then every 9-man squad has one radio for communicating to their base in case they get in trouble. They can get backup. But they get pretty stretched out on these streets. They move very fast, and they wind around through these little streets. So the front of the line of the squad can't see or communicate clearly with the last guy in the squad. So they have to buy their own Motorola walkie-talkies just off the market.
They buy their own walkie-talkies?
Yeah, they buy their own walkie-talkies. They buy components for their night vision sights. They have to buy their own knives. It's amazing.
How are they holding up psychologically? You have a sequence in your story that has to do with digital photos.
That sequence in the story is they were showing us digital photos of a car that had been hit. A car of Iraqi, it seemed to be resistance fighters, who had shot at a patrol at 4 in the morning, and they had shot the car with 2 rounds from a 50 caliber gun and killed 2 people in the car, blown the head off this one guy and blew open the abdomen of another guy. And a third guy was covered in brains and skull fragments and just crying. And the soldiers were recounting this and showing me photographs of this. And they were sort of hardened to it, but they're also aware of the fact that this seemed sick. And they were making jokes about it.
What do you mean, making jokes about it?
Well, this one guy who was crying, they said, one of their dudes came up to him and was like, "Hey, no crying in baseball." And they all started, you know, cracking jokes because, in fact, it was really, really horrible, especially when put in the context of the fact that they don't know whether they're going to get shot in response. They don't know when they're going to get out of there, and they're incredibly angry about it. And they turn a lot of this anger against the Iraqis because that's the acceptable place for it to go. And then that becomes problematic for the military's whole mission. They can't let the grunts shoot anything that moves and respond wildly anytime there's fire. So the officers then clamp down further on the soldiers, and so then that adds to this pressure cooker culture that one feels there. And a lot, you know, not this unit I wrote about, but other soldiers I hung out with, they're, you know, rather circumspect about this, but one way they deal with it is by taking drugs. And there's a pretty big pill scene in Iraq. So both Iraqi civilians and American soldiers are getting into sedatives and speed of different sorts, but mostly sedatives.
But, Christian, I have to ask you, they're soldiers, and war is hell. Are they whining a little bit more than they should be?
Well, I don't think they're whining. They were very clear about, you know, not wanting to be seen as whiners and pointing out the ways in which they had it easier than other units. But I think the main thing is that they're aware that there's no clear plan for this war. There's no exit strategy. They have no date to go home. A lot of them are veterans of the military. They did 4 years in the military. They became reservists or guardsmen and expected to be called up only for special duty, and now they've had their lives interrupted. The sergeant of the squad I was with has a building contractor, has, you know, employees and debts, and it's all going down the tubes while he's in Iraq. He doesn't know when he's going to go home, and his business is failing. And so they feel that it's unfair to put the burden of a war, which in many of their eyes has gone wrong, to dump this on people who have already done time in the military and had continued their lives and now are having those lives, marriages, and businesses destroyed by this patched together plan for occupation and counterinsurgency in Iraq.
Christian Parenti, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Christian Parenti's article, Stretched Thin, appears this week in The Nation. He's also the author of Soft Cage, a book about surveillance in America.
Two passings to note.
My name is George Plimpton. I'm the author of a new book, which is called Pet Peeves.
George Plimpton died at his home in Manhattan at the age of 76. The erudite, Harvard-educated author became a professional Walter Mitty, most famously joining the Detroit Lions in 1966 and writing about it in his book Paper Lion. George Plimpton was founder of Paris Review. His most recent book was titled The Paris Review Book of Heartbreak, Madness, Sex, Love, Betrayal, Outsiders, Intoxication, War, Whimsy, Horrors, God, Death, Dinner, Baseball, Travels, The Art of Writing, and Everything Else in the World Since 1953. Robert Palmer sang about most of the things in Plimpton's title. He was the erudite 80s pop icon in the suit and tie whose hits include Pressure Drop, Addicted to Love, and Simply Irresistible. Robert Palmer was working on a soundtrack when he died in Paris this morning. He was 54.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
What is Zen? Well, basically, it's a branch of Buddhism, the religion that emerged in northern India 2,500 years ago, founded by Buddha. Zen emphasizes meditation, kind of as a way to look reality straight in the eye and find peace with the way things are. Elusive, mystical. Zen can seem out there. Like that famous Zen riddle, what is the sound of one hand clapping? But when I recently asked 30-something American Zen Buddhist master, Brad Warner, what he thinks Zen is all about, he said it's very much about being right here.
It's always been, I think, about just ordinary people living ordinary lives and finding out what your ordinary life really is. Because your ordinary life is something really special and really wonderful, and you don't...
You get a hint right away, though, of how extraordinary Brad Warner's life's been from the title of his new book, Hardcore Zen, Punk Rock, Monster Movies, and the Truth About Reality. Brad was born in Ohio, went to college at Kent State, where he first got into both Zen and punk rock, fronting bands with names like Zero Defects and Dementia 13. No conflict there at all, Brad says.
And I thought there was some kind of relationship because what we were trying to do in the whole punk rock thing was to try to be very truthful and very straight without a lot of the BS that goes on that was surrounding the mainstream of rock at the time.
But after five hardcore punk albums left him hardcore broke, Brad decided to try his hand indulging another great passion of his youth, cheapo, goofball, Japanese Godzilla movies. He got a job in Japan with Tsuburaya Productions, where he still works.
Whenever they needed a foreign person in a scene, usually a reporter. I would be the foreign reporter, the American reporter. Basically, if you imagine Godzilla movies on a lower budget for half an hour apiece, that's what we make, all live action, and there's a superhero and a kind of Godzilla-type monster, and in every single episode, a Godzilla-type monster attacks Tokyo, and the superhero, Ultraman, beats him up.
In Japan, Brad's old interest in Zen Buddhism flowered. He met an elderly Zen teacher named Gudo Nishijima, who's 84 now and still works at a cosmetics company. After several years, Nishijima decided Brad understood Zen well enough to teach it. This punk rocker and monster movie fanatic from Middle America had become a Zen master.
What Nishijima teaches is called Shikantaza, which means just sitting, only sitting. So it's really, that's all it is. You're sitting in a certain position with your legs folded up into the lotus posture, staring at a wall. But they don't give you any mantras. They don't give you any funny questions to concentrate on. There's none of that. You're just sitting there. And it seems stupid. For years, I thought it was just the stupidest thing in the world. But for some reason, I enjoyed doing it, and I never felt right if I went a day without doing it. So just by doing that, a lot of the processes, a lot of the things you'd taken for granted in your own psychological makeup start to appear more clearly, and you can start to see what's going on in your own brain more clearly. And the most remarkable thing I discovered, it is that my thoughts are just thoughts. And if you just say that to somebody, they go, oh yeah, I know my thoughts are just thoughts. But you tend to believe your thoughts have some kind of great power or great meaning or great truth, and they're really nothing at all. They're just things bubbling around in your head. And, you know, it doesn't matter. These days, you know, I'll still get annoyed by things, but I notice that I'm annoyed and I go, well, I'm annoyed. And that doesn't annoy me. usually people layer on top of that. They get annoyed, and then they get annoyed because they're annoyed, and then it becomes a big deal, and they have to react to whatever's going on or whatever's making them upset. And if you practice for a while, that just seems silly. Getting angry, for example, which I was a world-class champion at for many years, which is one of the reasons, one of the things that drew me into hardcore punk, because it was very angry music, just seems silly.
You say that Zen is there's an ordinariness to Zen, and that its essence is really found within the ordinary. What do you mean by that?
Well, your ordinary life is the truth itself. There isn't any truth beyond the ordinary life you're living right now. So whether it's being a housewife or having kids and whatever, a truck driver or a doctor or whatever, this is your real life and this is reality. And there's no magic, great truth of the universe beyond that. That is the truth of the universe, which is hard for people to see because they want the truth of the universe to be somewhere out there where they can go and find it and they can go and search for it. But that's just putting things off. You're ignoring the great truth of the universe by trying to locate it somewhere else. And it's never somewhere else. It's always where you are and what you are. So in any situation, this is the truth. This is the ultimate truth.
Brad Warner's new book is called Hardcore Zen, Punk Rock, Monster Movies, and the Truth About Reality.
Next week on Here and Now, an update on a prescription drug plan for Medicare recipients. Why is it stuck on Capitol Hill?
And we meet author Jhumpa Lahiri. The acclaimed short story writer is out with her first novel. That's next week.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
We'll be right back.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, new Democratic candidate Wesley Clark in his first debate gets a warm welcome, including from Reverend Al Sharpton.
Welcome to the party. It's better to be a new Democrat that's a real Democrat than a lot of old Democrats up here that have been acting like Republicans all along.
And the yuppie thriller Cold Creek Manor.
We'll buy this house, please. It's so cool, can we?
I don't know. What do you think, Angel?
It's pretty cool. Mom, what do you think?
We'll see.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Another ambush of U.S. soldiers in Iraq has left one dead, two injured. It happened last night in the northern Iraq oil-producing city of Kirkuk when a rocket-propelled grenade was fired at their military vehicle. Meanwhile, residents of a town where a marketplace bombing killed nine civilians say the shell missed its real target, American troops stationed nearby. In addition to the dead, more than a dozen people were injured last night in the town, 30 miles north of Baghdad. As Israelis ring in the New Year holiday of Rosh Hashanah, they're also bringing in new security measures at their borders. Meanwhile, in New York, Secretary of State Colin Powell says the United States is still committed to the roadmap to peace despite continued violence.
But the United States is prepared to play the role of a open, honest broker, pressing both sides to meet the obligations and commitments that they have made and have under the roadmap.
United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan says both the Israelis and the Palestinians have failed to take steps along the roadmap. A major earthquake hits Japan, and experts are saying Japan is lucky the damage from the powerful tremor was not far worse. The U.S. Geological Survey says a magnitude 8 quake in northern Japan was the strongest in the world in the last 2.5 years. More than 300 people were injured. Two fishermen are missing, believed to have been swept away by waves. One of the first artists to make it big in the video music era has died. Robert Palmer died of a heart attack in Paris. He was 54. He became a star in the 1980s. With slick videos and sharp suits, his hits include Addicted to Love and Simply Irresistible. George Plimpton, author of Paper Lion and patron to writers including Jack Kerouac, has died. A friend of Plimpton says he died last night at his Manhattan apartment. In Paper Lion, Plimpton documented his time training with the Detroit Lions in 1963. He also acted in numerous movies, including Good Will Hunting and Reds. George Plimpton was 76 years old. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are lower. The Dow is down 22 points at 93.22. The NASDAQ is off 14 points at 18.02. The S&P is down 4 at 9.98.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In the third official debate last night between the now 10 Democratic presidential candidates, all eyes were on newly declared candidate Wesley Clark, who set one thing straight out of the box. He really is a Democrat.
I am pro-choice. I am pro-affirmative action. I'm pro-environment, pro-health. I believe the United States should engage with allies. We should be a good player in the international community, and we should use force only as a last resort. That's why I'm proud to be a Democrat.
Now, no one went at Clark, seeming to give the new guy a bit of a bye. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean even noted after the debate that Clark didn't make any mistakes. But Dean, the frontrunner in Iowa and New Hampshire, did come under fire, targeted especially by Congressman Richard Gebhardt for Dean's allegedly wobbly support for Medicare a decade or so ago.
Howard, you were agreeing with the very plan that Newt Gingrich wanted to pass, which was a $270 billion cut in Medicare. Now, you've been saying for many months that you're the head of the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. I think you're just winging it.
Dean really bristled at that in an otherwise mostly very gloves-on debate. Well, here to discuss Clark's debut and other debate matters is our weekly editorial roundtable. Bill Nemitz, columnist for the Portland Press-Herald in Portland, Maine, joins us. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
And Dorothy Rabinowitz, who's a member of the editorial board at The Wall Street Journal. And welcome to you, Dorothy.
Thanks.
Dorothy, to you first. The Wall Street Journal co-sponsored the debate with CNBC. Now, General Clark's shown Republican tendencies over the years, including praising the present administration in its early days. But he said he's made an incredible journey since then. I want to ask you, in a moment, whether that sounded credible to you. But first, let's just hear a bit of Wesley Clark from the debate.
I've been in the race about 9 days, so I don't have a complete package of health care proposals. But here's what I would do. I think as we move toward this, we need to take the existing programs. We need to build on the existing programs.
General Clark sounding perhaps a bit unformed last night, doesn't have a health policy just yet. Dorothy, how did he come off?
He came off, I thought, tentative. People were very kind to him, I suppose, as befits somebody who wears a uniform and looks engaging, but he was completely indefinite about everything in ways that you really don't expect of a candidate. And as for being a Democrat in his bones and sinews, I think if you look at the very good Newsweek piece about him and credit quite a reliable story about calling the White House and asking to be a part of the war on terror and then being refused and then saying, had they accepted my phone call, had Karl Rove done so, I'd be a Republican. And it's alleged that in his bitterness he became a Democrat. It sounds a bit oversimple, but the answer to your question, I have to say, is I thought he was most unimpressive.
Bill, your thoughts? Most unimpressive or a glint of maybe stronger things to come from the general?
Well, I was certainly expecting more. By the end of the debate, I was thinking if he says he's only been in this race for 9 days one more time, I'm going to put my foot through the television. And I think time will tell whether we have a formidable candidate on our hands. Even at this point, I'm starting to see little echoes of Ross Perot here, you know, in terms of how people seem to be fawning over him without really having a good sense as to what he stands for. And I think there's a long way to go with this guy.
Yeah, the jury out. Howard Dean was once again, and maybe somewhat surprisingly, I don't know, the punching bag. Let's listen to one thing he had to say, defining who he is in kind of a negative way.
To listen to Senator Lieberman, Senator Kerry, Representative Gephardt, I'm anti-Israel, I'm anti-trade, and I'm anti-Medicare, and I'm anti-Social Security. I wonder how I ended up in the Democratic Party. I'm not a new entrant to the Democratic Party. I've been here a long time.
How did he come off, Dorothy?
Oh,
he's the front runner, I guess.
Oh, I think he came off well, as he's come off all along. I think he's their guy. Hmm. He speaks to their base. He knows what he thinks. He exudes a feeling of knowing what he thinks, which is not a small thing. I mean, if you compare him to, say, John Edwards, who, in his blow-dry way, looks very much like a snake oil salesman, in Howard Dean, who, by the way, owes the general a lot, compared to the general, Howard Dean is Franklin Roosevelt.
You know, Dorothy, that every time Edwards began an answer by saying, I'm going to give you a real simple answer here. I thought, oh, no, here we go. In other words, we're going to get a non-answer here, and that's what we got from him.
Bill Nemitz, what about John Kerry? Now, here's a guy with a heck of a war record and many other things to his credit that should be appealing to Democrats, but he just doesn't seem to ignite any passion. Let's listen to John Kerry on whether he'd approve President Bush's $87 billion request for Iraq and Afghanistan.
If we're going to pass any money at all, it ought to come at the expense of President Bush's ill-advised, unaffordable tax cut, which is driving this country into deficit. Secondly, there are some other conditions that I think are critical, and until I know how that comes out in the struggle, I can't tell you exactly where I'm going to vote.
Bill Nemitz, maybe saved by the bell there. unlike Dean, who, as Dorothy was pointing out, tends to take positions, mm-hmm. John Kerry tends to waffle. Am I missing something?
Well, I think that bell was actually significant because Kerry talked a lot. I mean, he went over the bell almost every time, but each time I found myself wondering, what did he say? And I think we're fast approaching the point with this large field of candidates where they're going to have to stop agreeing that George Bush is the enemy for now and start mixing it up a little bit more. We saw that between Gephardt and Dean last night. And Kerry, you'll notice, jumped into that subsequently, but it wasn't his attack. It was Gephardt's. And I think he needs to initiate more of that passion and stop being such a statesman.
Dorothy, toe-to-toe with President Bush, who could you envision being most effective several months from now when it's a Republican and a Democrat running against each other?
Well, if you're talking about the Democratic base, I think it's Howard Dean, and perhaps even in the general election, I think it's Howard Dean. But if I could say about Kerry, last night was one of the few times I've seen him somewhat attached to reality when he said things like, or he said this thing, he said, you can't want jobs and despise the people who create them.
Yeah, that was a good line.
That was one good line. But it is true. You can't have these two people saying we can't fight with each other. We have to fight George Bush. And this is kind of nonsense. Do they really expect the electorate to listen to this piety? They want to know who's the best guy in a scrap. But I tell you, I think they have found in Howard Dean their man, even in a general election. Look at him, that George kind of dimpled face, even if he's surly around the eyes. He doesn't give. That counts for a lot.
He's going to have to be careful, though, because he was clearly irritated at Gephardt last night when he invoked Gingrich. And that's great. I mean, it made for great television in what was otherwise a brutally long 2 hours. But what I'm still waiting to see is what Howard Dean does when he gets really mad and it's not in his interest to show it.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, we're going to be seeing a lot more of all these guys. And the one gal who we didn't get to talk to, unfortunately, Carol Moseley Braun. But we do have to wrap it up at this point. And I want to thank you both for joining us. Bill Nemitz, columnist for the Portland Press-Herald in Portland, Maine. Thanks, Bill.
My pleasure, Bill.
And Dorothy Rabinowitz, who's a member of the editorial board at the Wall Street Journal. Thanks a lot, Dorothy.
You're very welcome.
Still to come, Mike Figgis' new thriller, Cold Creek Manor, meant to make yuppies squirm.
You're listening to Here and Now. If you're the partner of someone on the Atkins diet, you better think twice about reaching for that sandwich at lunch. As the ubiquitous low-carbohydrate Atkins diet spreads, spouses of the dieters are running into previously unforeseen health risks. While the dieters manage to lose weight by cutting out breads and pastas and replacing them with more meats and fats, some partners end up eating the added fats but continue to eat high-carbohydrate foods. Now, the results for the partner can range from high cholesterol to high blood pressure to simply fights over the food. Well, here to join us now are Margie McGraw and Kate Solomon, a couple from Newton, Massachusetts. Kate is on the Atkins diet, while Margie is not. And welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Well, Margie, how are things going?
Well, Bill,
you're not on the diet.
So far, I'm enjoying myself tremendously.
You're eating everything.
I am eating everything. There's pate. There's brie. I'm having steak for dinner. Uh-huh. My meals are cooked for me. I'm in hog's heaven, Bill.
But are you gaining weight?
Well, so far, I'm not. But I think chances are, if this continues, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, wow. Kate, how's the Atkins diet been going for you?
It's fine. You know, I'm a major carnivore, so I couldn't be happier.
Steak, pasta, the works at your house. How are you going to work it all out?
Well, Margie did the other day make chocolate chip cookies because she was having, you know, an intense need for carbohydrates. And she did hide them from me and then distributed them around the neighborhood. So the neighbors were quite happy.
Oh, jeez. So, Margie, just to get serious for a second, how concerned are you about the pitfalls of all this? High cholesterol, you could gain weight.
while Just Maybe Kate is looking better than ever.
I'm not hugely concerned because I am a creature of moderation. Uh-huh. However, I am concerned. I haven't cut out any carbos. And Kate mentioned the chocolate chip cookies. So, again, while I'm eating all this delicious, you know, cholesterol-saturated food, I'm maintaining my usual carbo intake.
Yeah, yeah. Kate, are you concerned? I mean, can you make this work in a partnership?
Well, I think, you know, this is really why I'm doing it. It's not so much about me losing weight. It's that I want Margie to bulk up so that we won't be so disparate in size.
There is some serious problem here, though, isn't there?
Because Margie is so moderate in her eating, I think that she'll be able to figure it out. I'm really not worried about her.
Now, you guys are raising kids, too, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, what about them? Or do you just not worry so much about a child's fat intake?
Well, Maddie is a vegetarian, so now we've got who's like, you know, carnivore. We've got moderate Margie, and we've got Maddie the vegetarian who, like, lives on carbohydrates. So all she eats is pasta anyway. She's
You're covering every possible base in that household.
I'm telling you, it's a lot of cooking.
True.
Just to finish up then, though, what are you going to do in a few weeks or a month if Margie starts to, you know, I mean, this is not going to work according to everything we know. This is going to be a problem.
I'll have to separate from her.
No, seriously, I have to make kind of a more concerted effort to cut back. You know, I really do. And again, it's hard when there, as I said, there's these delicious foods in the refrigerator that aren't typically there. So I'm going to have to exercise. I'm going to have to exercise more, and I'll have to exercise more restraint.
The pitfalls of the one Atkins diet couple. Thank you both for joining us on it.
Thanks, Bill.
Margie McGraw and Kate Solomon, a couple from Newton, Massachusetts. Kate is on the Atkins diet. Margie is not.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In 1996, there were signs of a resistance towards the regime of Saddam Hussein. Four men attempted to kill Saddam's son, Uday, but Uday was crippled by their bullets, not assassinated. Christian Science Monitor reporter Peter Ford met with one of those involved in that attempt, who tells his story to a foreign paper for the first time in today's issue. Peter Ford joins us on the line from Baghdad. Hello.
Hello.
This gentleman you spoke with, Salman Sharif, was a member of the 15 Shaban movement. What was that?
It was, and still is now, a political party, an Islamist party made up of Shia Muslims from the south based in Nazaria, which is where Mr. Sharif now lives. But they were basically operating out of the southern marshes.
And they had participated in the failed uprising against Saddam Hussein in 91.
That's right. They had been a clandestine organization before they came above ground during the uprising. But when Saddam's forces crushed that rebellion, they fled to the marshes.
Now, you tell the story of this failed assassination attempt and set the scene for us, the one that Sharif tells you about scouting the streets where Uday was expected to be and those streets filled with informants.
Uday Hussein, Saddam Hussein's elder son, was notorious for womanizing, and brutal womanizing, and he used to troll for pretty women on Thursday nights in Mansour, which is an upscale district of Baghdad. And when Sharif heard about this, he spent 2 months every Thursday checking out these streets and figuring out who were informers, who were security men, which traffic policemen were really traffic policemen, which were security people, and working out which would be the safest place to launch this attack.
Tell us about the assassination attempt itself.
Just after 7 o'clock, the four members of the hit team who were eating ice cream and keeping their eyes peeled for Uday Hussein saw his car crawl slowly up the road towards them. One of the four men, who was the driver, drove his car into the shadows. The other three moved to the position which they chose for the assassination attempt. When the car pulled up to their position, they pulled the guns out of the bag and opened up. It took less than a minute. I think they just emptied their magazines as fast as they could, threw their guns down, and ran.
They severely injured Uday. They weren't able to assassinate him. And the retaliation wasn't immediate, but it was deadly.
Yes, and it was 18 months before the regime finally figured out who had done it. And once the regime had the names, even though they couldn't capture all four men, they executed the males in their families. So Mr. Sharif, for example, all seven of his brothers and his father were executed.
As you said, this then resistance group is now an official political party in Iraq. How does Salman Sharif look back on that assassination attempt, given that Uday was ultimately killed?
Well, despite the price that he and his family paid, he still believes it was worth it because it sent a message back in 1996 that there was resistance inside Iraq to Saddam Hussein, which was something the regime wanted to hide, even though it wasn't very widespread. They say it was because they shed their blood, because groups like theirs made sacrifices, that they have a right to demand proper democracy and proper elections now.
Mm. And Salman Sharif, he's telling his story. How safe does he feel now?
He seems still rather wary. It was not easy to track him down. I had to go from one person to another to another. And when he eventually saw me, I was taken to an empty house in a small town outside Nasiriyah, and he came later once they'd obviously checked out who I was and who I was with. But slowly, the 15th Shaban movement is coming up into the open air, and they're going to be fighting for political power. I don't know how successful they'll be, but certainly the individual members of those groups are personally very popular in the areas where they live.
Well, Peter, thank you so much. It's really quite a story.
You're welcome.
Peter Ford of the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. To read today's article, go to our website, here-now.org. Insecure times produce some pretty jittery audiences. That theory has been fodder for filmmakers for decades. And now, director Mike Figgis, best known for his 1997 Academy Award-winning film Leaving Las Vegas, is the latest to use contemporary fears and anxieties to fuel his new movie, Cold Creek Manor. It stars Sharon Stone and Dennis Quaid as a city couple looking to have a go at country living. But the big old house they end up buying, the house that's too good to be true, is. It has a secret, scary past, at least according to its previous owner.
Please, don't feel bad. A house is just a shell, right? You live in it for a while, then things change. Now it's yours. I do have one question for you, though. Do you know what you're getting yourself into?
They may not, but you will have no excuse, because Here and Now's film reviewer Eric Schaefer is in the studio with his thoughts on Mike Figgis' Cold Creek Manor. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Robin.
Well, let's see, another yuppie horror flick. You know, a yuppie couple moves to the country, hilarity ensues. I mean, horror ensues.
We would have all been better off if hilarity had ensued. But yeah, it follows a pretty straightforward, generic line.
It seems as if it's a genre. I'm thinking Hand That Rocks the Cradle. They didn't move to the country, but there's sort of a...
Right. There are these movies which really do kind of tend to play on the fears of middle and upper middle class folk, like Pacific Heights and Cape Fear and Panic Room and so on. And this movie falls squarely in that tradition.
What contemporary fears are we talking about?
Well, for the most part in this movie, we're initially talking about fears of the city, you know, the stresses and the traumas of urban living. And there is a trauma that occurs in the Tilson family that sends them off to the country, up into upstate New York, looking to sort of escape life in the city. And, of course, they run headlong into other problems.
And by the way, this is something that a lot of New Yorkers are doing. They're getting their country home, sort of the Hudson Valley area, Ichabod Crane territory, by the way.
Right. And I think, you know, that's the case in a lot of cities across the country. People are, you know, simply frightened about living in cities these days with everything that's happening. And so they're heading out to the country,
where their worst fears are imagined. I mean, that of course, is the twist.
Well, that's largely the twist. I mean, in this film, we wind up with this sort of locals versus the newcomers kind of story. You know, we've seen elements of that in movies like Deliverance.
I was going to say, do they go canoeing?
Yeah, well, almost. You know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is kind of the granddaddy of those films. And, of course, when they get there and they begin to renovate this house, things go wrong because the son of the family who lived there, Dale Massey, played by Stephen Dorff, gets out of prison. He shows up on their doorstep. And, of course, he winds up being this sort of sinister figure, this very menacing fellow who manages to get in most of his menace through sort of innuendo, such as when he's talking with Sharon Stone, the mother, about her daughter.
Oh, we didn't know it was going to be this hot.
I don't think your daughter likes me very much.
Oh, sure she does. She's just a bit shy.
She's a pretty girl.
Yeah.
Just like her mama.
What is Mike Figgis trying to say?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure he's successful in what he's trying to say in this movie, but there is kind of an interesting subtext here, and it's basically about dissolution of family. We're told the story of these two different families, the Tilsons, who moved to, you know, upstate New York to Cold Creek Manor, and then the original owners of this fine old house, the Masseys, who evidently had been very rich and powerful at one time, but they had fallen on hard times. So a lot of the anxiety comes from this notion of families that are falling apart, economic insecurity. And I think that Figgis is trying to say something about that, but instead what we're getting is a pretty conventional thriller.
Well, Mike Figgis is known for Leaving Las Vegas, that extraordinary, agonizing film about alcoholism.
A great movie, yeah.
Starring Nicolas Cage and Elizabeth Shue. It was made for this small budget, you know, relatively $3.5 million. So now he had a lot of money to make this big movie. Is it on the screen, as they say?
It's really not. I mean, the film, unfortunately, looks pretty conventional. You know, Figgis has done some really inventive stuff. Time Code, the movie which you saw four different stories playing out all at the same time in this screen that was, you know, in four different sections. So he's clearly somebody who has the capacity to be tremendously inventive, to really be very fearless as he was in Leaving Las Vegas. But here, I think it could have probably been a pretty tight, pretty energetic little thriller. But, you know, it has a lot of problems with the screenplay. And as we've said on the show numerous times, that, you know, movies are made or broken with screenplays. And most viewers are going to realize that, you know, we've been down this road before a number of times. And, you know, in the past, that road has often been a whole lot more frightening.
Well, Eric, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
You can't say you weren't warned. Here now is film reviewer Eric Schaefer with his thoughts on Cold Creek Manor.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
We'll have an update on a Medicare prescription drug plan stuck on Capitol Hill.
And we'll meet Jhumpa Lahiri, the acclaimed short story writer, is out with her first novel.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.